5. The last time Dale had seen his young lover, Claire, more than a year earlier in the clean, bright, achingly blue sky Montana mid-September, they had saddled up at the ranch, she on the spirited roan he had bought for his oldest daughter and that his daughter had ridden only twice but that Claire had ridden a score of times, he on the docile, older gelding that had come with the ranch, and then they had led 2 pack mules up into the high country for a 3-day camping trip. The weather stayed perfect during the entire long weekend. The great clone groves of aspen covering the subalpine hillsides had gone golden earlier that week, and because it had been a wet, warm summer, the leaves were a perfect yellow gold, shimmering against the blue vaulted sky and filling the hillsides and valleys below them with a constantly dancing light. Claire reminded him that aspen leaves glittered that way because they were attached to the branch at a slight angle, so that both sides of each leaf could photosynthesize during the short growing season. Dale reminded her that he had taught her that a year earlier. The first night they camped below treeline, and they allowed themselves the luxury of a small campfire, sitting around it and talking over coffee for hours as the stars burned almost without twinkling above them. Before Dale lit the fire, Claire gave him a small box wrapped in perfect gold paper. He looked at her quizzically.
"A small present," she said.
"What's the occasion?" asked Dale.
"Open it," said Claire.
Inside the box was a beautiful gold Dunhill cigarette lighter.
"It's beautiful," said Dale.
"But I know that you know that I don't smoke."
"You don't light campfires all that well either,"
said Claire.
"I remember Ghost Ridge. Your matches are always wet or missing or something. That thing might save your life someday."
Dale had laughed and lighted their stack of kindling and wood with 2 flicks of the lighter. There had been several nights of frost, so there were no mosquitoes. The breeze from the high ridges was cold, but the fire was warm and they were comfortable in leather riding coats over fleece vests and flannel shirts. Claire told him about the first days of her graduate program at Princeton. He told her about the new book he had begun, a serious novel about Custer at the Little Bighorn, from the Native American perspective. Claire winced, as she always did, at the term Native American, but she made no issue of it this time. Neither of them mentioned the reason for her long flight back and extended weekend with him at such an important time in her life, namely, their plans to get together this year, Dale's hopes of spending Thanksgiving break with her, their earlier plans to travel to Barbados during her Christmas break, their ultimate plans of Dale moving near Princeton to be with her starting the following summer, taking at least a year of sabbatical from his university, and perhaps quitting to write full-time, all of their plans, all of their futures. They made love for hours by the dying campfire that first night, spreading Dale's sleeping bag out on the soft grass and using Claire's as a blanket over them when the cold winds blew over their sweaty bodies. Eventually, the campfire embers dimmed and they slept a while, making love in the middle of the night and again just after sunrise. Dale noticed that Claire's lovemaking was more intense than ever, as if she were trying to lose herself in the intimacy, thus putting distance between them. And he knew then that when they did talk, the news would be bad. The second night, camped high on the ridge above treeline, they used only the white gas backpacking stove for cooking and adjourned early to the tent as a freezing wind from outer space seemed to blow in. There was even less atmosphere up there to make the stars twinkle, but they seemed to shake more, as if also blasted by the Arctic winds that made Claire and Dale huddle in their goose-down bags as they stroked each other and made love repeatedly, finding their orgasms separately and then together, knowing and respecting each other's bodies and needs in the way only lovers long experienced with each other can appreciate true lovemaking. It was not enough. Dale again felt the distance and lay awake after Claire's slow breathing began, the soft sighing of sleep lost in the wind against rainfly nylon noise, but stirring warm and tactile against his bare shoulder. He knew for certain now that something was wrong. The day's dialogues had been enthusiastic but abstract, intimate but impersonal, occasionally touching on their past experiences, but never turning toward a shared future. This was profoundly different, and as Dale lay awake, feeling his young beloved breathe on his shoulder,
He thought of Anne and the girls, lost to him now by choice and action, and of the house in Missoula, and of his job and the long academic year ahead, an unbelievably empty year if he was not pursuing his sabbatical as he and Clara had planned, and now he felt the cold and vacuum of the dark sky enter into him, until he was shaking, even in the warmth of the enveloping sleeping bags with Claire's warm, bare breasts and thigh against him. He shivered and waited for dawn. She told him the next day. As they led the pack mules down the couloir toward the high pastures above the ranch. "It's not going to work, Dale." He did not have to ask her what was not going to work. It was the great unspoken topic of the long weekend, of their life. And he played no games just to make himself feel better by seeing her feel worse. "All right," he said. "Why not?" She had hesitated then. It was a warm day, and she was wearing his oldest, most comfortable flannel shirt, the blue one that she had worn that first weekend, more than 4 years earlier, and that she wore each time they spent time together, wore it open today, sleeves rolled up, a white T-shirt showing the strain of the full breasts he had kissed at sunrise just hours ago. "It's the way you predicted," she said at last. "I'm too old," said Dale. They had come to a steep pitch, and he instinctively leaned back in the saddle and put more weight on the stirrups to help the gelding keep its footing. Claire was doing the same with the roan.
"I'm too young," she said.
For 4 years she had insisted, sometimes violently, that their age difference had made no difference. He had always disagreed with her. He wished she would disagree with herself now. "There's no room for me in your life at Princeton," he said. "You're with people your own age, and it's a relief."
"No,"
she said, and then,
"Yes."
"You're with someone else," he said, hearing the hopeless flatness in his voice despite himself. They rode into an aspen grove alive with shimmer and the dry autumn rasping of heart-shaped leaves.
"No,"
she said again.
"Not completely with, not in love. I don't think I'll be in love again for a long, long time, but there is someone I'm attracted to, someone I've been spending time with."
During the summer pre-program seminars, Dale hated asking questions right then, but could not have stopped himself if his life depended upon it. Perhaps his life did depend upon it. His voice sounded alien and dead, even to him. The aspen leaves rattled and the wind stirred the dry, high grass. As they rode out into the upper pasture, Claire's nipples were hard against the thin cotton of her T-shirt. Her cheeks were flushed. She looked beautiful. At that moment, he almost hated her for that.
"Sure,"
she said.
"I met him then."
"Have you?" He stopped himself just in time and looked away, west, down the long canyon. The ranch was not quite in sight. He knew that it would not look the same to him when it did appear through the pines.
"Slept with him?"
finished Claire.
"Yes. We've had sex. It's part of my new life there. Exciting."
"Exciting," repeated Dale. One of their generational differences over the past 4 years of surprise encounter, attraction, involvement, had been her use of the phrase "having sex," and his old fogey insistence on his version of making love. Eventually, she had spoken of their lovemaking only as lovemaking. Dale had seen it as a great step forward in their relationship. He chuckled at that now, feeling no mirth whatsoever. The gelding tried to look around at him, as if he had given it a confusing command through his legs or the reins. He kicked it in the ribs to keep up with Claire's roan, who had to be held back from a canter this close to the ranch.
"Exciting," said Claire. "But you know me. You must know how little it means."
Dale now laughed with some sincerity. "I don't know you, Claire. That's all that I do know right now."
"Don't make it difficult, Dale."
"Heaven forbid."
"You predicted this 1,000 times. No matter how often I said that it wouldn't play out this way, you insisted it would. Every time I wanted to settle things between us, about Anne and the children, this was one of your reasons for waiting. What I didn't understand was that—"
"All right," said Dale, interrupting her with a harsher note than he had meant to use. "You're right. I understood then. I understand now. You just denied that it could happen so many times that I got stupid. I sold myself on the fantasy.
I don't want to hurt you any more than... What do you say we shut up for now and just talk later during the drive back to the airport? Let's just enjoy the last half hour or so of the trip.
They did not, of course, enjoy the end of the camping trip or talk during the ride back to Missoula. It was the last time he had seen Claire. It was 2 months before he loaded the Savage over and under, set the barrel against his brow, clicked off the safety, and pulled the trigger. It was 10 months before he decided to spend his sabbatical year riding in Illinois. It was 1 year, 6 weeks, and 3 days before he arrived at his dead friend Duane's house in this godforsaken exile in Illinois. But who was counting? It took Dale a while to unload the Land Cruiser and to find someplace for his stuff. The boxes of books and winter clothes could wait, of course, but he wanted to set up his ThinkPad computer somewhere comfortable and to dig out the clean sheets, pillowcases, towels, and other items he had brought from the ranch. Everything personal, he realized, was going into the parlor study where Mr. McBride had slept long ago and where Mr. McBride's aging sister had lived, without changing anything, for most of the past 40 years. The ThinkPad went on the old desk comfortably enough. The wall outlet had no polarizer holes, but Dale had anticipated that and brought a 2-prong adapter for the surge protector. Sandy Whitaker had warned him that there had been no phone lines to the house since 1960, but Dale had brought his cell phone. The phone was equipped for email, of course, but he was old-fashioned, and he made the infrared connections to the ThinkPad and dialed up the Peoria AOL access number. His phone informed him that there was no service, none at all. He could not even make a telephone call.
"Shit," said Dale.
He had deliberately checked with Illinois Bell to make sure that there was service to this part of the country. Well, this had to be some sort of local glitch, a cell shadow, or perhaps even a problem with the cell phone itself. He could always drive a few miles to get back into clear reception to make his calls and launch his emails. The thought gave him a frisson that was not totally unpleasant. It had been years since he had been so isolated. Even at the ranch, he'd had the C-band antenna pulling in a score of satellites for TV, some of them broadcasting in high definition now, and 2 regular phone lines, one dedicated for fax, as well as his mobile phone. Now he was quiet. Hell, he thought, I wanted time for serious reading, research, this will help. He wanted to believe it. Dale unpacked more stuff through the dim afternoon. He knew that he should drive to Oak Hill and do some grocery shopping. He'd be damned if he'd go to something called the Quick and Easy, but he had packed a cooler for the trip with some sandwiches, 3 bottles of beer, some orange juice, a few apples and oranges, other stuff, and it seemed still good. He set these few things in the refrigerator, decided he was hungry, and had one of the ham sandwiches and a beer for lunch. For years, every time he had packed a lunch to eat in his office at the university or for a trip, Anne had done something she first started while packing picnics during their honeymoon 27 years earlier. When Dale unwrapped his sandwich, there would always be a single bite taken out of it, a salutation, Beatrice saying salve to young Dante. A reminder. There were no bites taken out of this sandwich, nor would there be any in the future. Dale shook his head. He was still tired, and the beer had not helped that, but this was no time for more self-pity. He carried the last couple of boxes in from the truck. The sheets and clean blankets and pillowcases and towels were in the last box, of course, and he took his time unpacking them. The sheets were too big for the small bed in the study, but he folded them over until they fit without too much wrinkling. The thick towels looked out of place in the severe bathroom. It was getting dark. Dale went into the parlor and wandered through the dining room and back into the kitchen. No TV had magically appeared. It would have been nice to watch the network news and then the local news from Peoria. Even nicer to catch CNN headline news or call up some news sites on the net. He went back to pull the last of the extra towels and sheets from the boxes. His Savage over-and-under shotgun 22 rifle was packed beneath the bottom layer of towels, wrapped in plastic, broken into its 2 component parts, but clearly oiled and ready. Dale actually took a step back from the box in shock. He not only clearly remembered not packing the weapon, he remembered where he had put it. In the basement at the ranch, wrapped in its soft gun case, far back on the highest and hardest-to-reach storage shelf. Dale's hands were shaking as he lifted the old weapon out of the box and carefully unwrapped it. At least there was no ammunition. Neither 22 shells nor shotgun shells for the 410. He looked in the lower breech. A shotgun shell was nestled there. Dale had to try three times before his fingers could extricate it. It was the shell. The one from 4 a.m. on November 4th, almost a year earlier. Dale could clearly see the indentation where the firing pin had struck the center of the shell. Fire in the hole, he thought. A shell on which the firing pin had dropped could, theoretically, go off at any time. Even more clear than his recollection of wrapping and storing the Savage in the basement of the ranch was his memory of throwing the shell far out from the porch, deep into the Douglas fir and lodgepole pines there. I am nuts. I've gone fucking crazy again. He reached for the phone and actually speed-dialed Dr. Hall's office number before the no-service sign on the LCD reminded him that such a quick sanity fix was no longer an option. Jesus Christ, Dale said aloud. He set the phone back, weighed the death shell in his palm, went to the back door, walked out into the muddy lot and the freezing rain, and threw the shell as far out into the stubbled cornfield as he could. Then he went back into Duane's farmhouse and went through every other box he had brought in, dumping scores of books on the floor of the dining room and study, throwing clothes on the sagging furniture, leaving his stuff on every surface until he was confident that he had not packed any other ammunition. Finally, he carried the rewrapped Savage over and under down to the basement, Duane's basement, filled with lamps and warm from the furnace, finally setting one piece of the weapon behind a workbench and the other piece in a small niche filled with bell jars in which small, bloody human organs seemed to be floating. Tomatoes, he thought. Then he went upstairs, read for an hour or two, starting with Dante's Inferno, but soon switching to a Donald Westlake Dortmunder comedy mystery, and turned off the light by 8 p.m., but not before he went into the bathroom and took 2 Flurazepam and 3 Doxepin. He would sleep this night. Sometime around 3:30 a.m., he could not quite read the dial of his watch because his mind and eyes were so fuzzy from the medication, Dale woke to the sound of the dog growling in the kitchen. He realized that he was not at the ranch, that he must have fallen asleep again on the leather couch in his study in the Missoula house, and he wished that Anne or one of the girls would let the dog, Hasso, out. The growling grew louder and then faded. Dale started to fade as well, but then the girls began stomping and thumping upstairs. No, the footfalls were much too heavy to be the girls. They must have some boys visiting. So late? Dale thought fuzzily. And isn't Mab in college? While he tried to sort this out and simultaneously figure out why his leather couch was so hard and lumpy, the upstairs thumping stopped, but another dog began howling just outside. Probably the Becker's dog outside again. He knew he should get up and let Hasso out, then go upstairs to bed. Anne would chide him in the morning about falling asleep downstairs again, but he was just too damn tired. He went back down into a drugged sleep to the sound of Hasso's nails scraping on the tile of the kitchen just down the hall. 6. I said that I did not know the details of my own death, and that is true, but I know very well, better than Dale himself, the details of Dale's attempted suicide. He had been alone at the ranch for almost 5 months when Claire visited for the last time in September a year ago. He had confronted Anne in the spring, moved out of his Missoula home in April, saw the girls only sporadically over the summer, and never at the ranch, since Mab refused to visit there and Katie followed her lead, and then was truly and totally and irreversibly alone come the middle of September when Claire said goodbye and flew back to Princeton. Dale had not been sleeping well during the spring and summer, and by the time the cottonwood and aspen leaves had fallen in the hills and valleys around the ranch, he was not really sleeping at all. Night was a vortex of thought, a firestorm of frenzied and useless mental activity. He would wander the dark rooms of the ranch, ending up in his study there, the wind rattling the wall of windows, sitting in the blue-lighted dark, writing letter after letter, usually to Claire, but sometimes to Anne, frequently to Mab or Katie, occasionally to friends he had not seen for years, and then, come dawn, he would destroy the letters and try for an hour or two of dream-plagued dozing. His teaching at the university, already on autopilot, went to hell. The head of the department, no friend, called him in to warn him. The dean, an old friend, finally followed suit, explaining that she knew about Dale's divorce, knew that he had been drinking, and suggested ways that she and his other colleagues could help. Dale ignored the suggestions. Dale had not been drinking. Alcohol interested him no more than did food. He lost almost 30 pounds between the middle of September and November 4th of that year. His short-term memory had all but ceased to exist, and he had reached the point where he was getting essentially zero REM sleep. One of his English department colleagues suggested that Dale's eyes looked like two cigarette holes burned through a white sheet. Dale had never heard that cliché before. He had been spared it until then, he told the colleague, but now that he had heard it, he thought of it every time he looked into a mirror. Dale rode the gelding through the valleys and orchards near the ranch, sometimes staying out for days at a time, eating nothing but the occasional hard tack, brewing thick coffee over campfires and sleeping under thin blankets. He was sure that the gelding thought he was crazy. He was not sure that the gelding was wrong. In the third week of October that year, after having written and deleted more than a score of letters, after having picked up the telephone 100 times only to put it down after dialing the number in Princeton, but before he heard a ring, Dale threw some clean underwear, extra jeans, his old blue flannel shirt, and a water bottle into his canvas pack, jumped into the Land Cruiser at 10:30 one night, and drove toward Princeton, following I-90 through Wyoming, South Dakota, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Chicago, northern Indiana, northern Ohio, the corner of Pennsylvania, and western New York, until he finally pulled over to sleep on the New York Thruway 63 hours after he had left, awoke, realizing that this was the wrong thing to do, and drove slowly back to Montana, swinging north from Minneapolis to I-94 and then across a suddenly wintry North Dakota. In the last few days of October, he had written a 64-page poem, a combination epic odyssey of his drive and a letter of love and understanding to Claire. Personally, I think the thing is a masterpiece of madness, a logical explication of total freewheeling insanity, and perhaps the most interesting thing Dale Stewart had written to that point. Unfortunately, while he would never have lifted such a pathetic thing set down on paper, placed it in an envelope, found a stamp for it, and driven it to a mailbox, he had written it as an email attachment. Weighing on him so heavily it had no real weight, he emailed it at 3:26 a.m. on November 1st, using Claire's new university email address, which he had looked up on Bigfoot. Dale slept for 6 hours that day, the longest uninterrupted rest he had enjoyed in more than a month. The one-line note and 64-page attachment returned later that day, forwarded back to him without comment, almost certainly unread. Dale was not surprised. He deleted all copies of the poem. The next 72 hours are essentially lost to Dale. His sleep deprivation had reached the point of brain cell death, but I am aware of every hour and minute of his wandering through the ranch, his muttering in the middle of the night, his repeated walks to the barn as if to saddle up his gelding, which was already stabled for the winter down in Missoula, and his 100 false starts at emailing or calling Claire or Anne or someone. At a little before 4 o'clock on the morning of November 4th, Dale got out of bed after 6 hours of lying there awake, wrote a brief note on a post-it pad. The note read, "Don't come inside, call the county sheriff," and gave the sheriff office's phone number, which he had to look up in his county directory, stuck the note on the inside of the back door window pane, pulled his Savage over and under out of the closet and out of its old canvas case, went into his office, unlocked a drawer, fumbled a .410 shell out, loaded the shotgun, paused a moment to consider which room would be most appropriate, and then went into the master bathroom, knelt on the tiles, set the muzzle of the shotgun against his forehead, selected the correct firing chamber with a click, and, with no hesitation or final thoughts, pulled the trigger. The hammer fell. The firing pin clicked. The shell did not fire. Dale knelt there for several minutes, waiting. It was as if time had stretched out in his final instant of life, rather like the mathematics of a person falling into a black hole where seconds become eternities just before time itself disappears into the singularity forever. But the shotgun blast never came. Eventually, Dale lowered the barrel, broke the breech, and looked at the shell, wondering if some cowardly part of his subconscious had selected the .22 barrel rather than the loaded shotgun. No, the firing pin had fallen on the shell. Dale could see the dent in the center of the brass circle. Dale's father had given him the Savage over and under when Dale was 8 years old. He had fired it hundreds of times, cleaned and oiled it well, stored it carefully, and never abused it. It had never misfired before, not once. After a while, Dale's knees became sore from kneeling on the bathroom tiles. He got up, removed the shell, propped the shotgun against the bedroom wall, set the misfired shell on the bookcase, took the note down from the back door, and slept for 3 hours. When he awoke, he called his doctor. Within 48 hours, he had an appointment with a Missoula psychiatrist, Dr. Charles Hall. The talk therapy was useless. The Prozac began to help about 2 months later. What I find interesting about this is not that Dale tried to kill himself. It was the fatigue and depression that led to that, not any self-pity he was generating. And I can say with more confidence than he could what his motivations were during this entire pathetic, disoriented time, but the fact that he chose suicide at all. Dale Stewart had always despised the idea of suicide and felt anger toward those who tried it and a real fury toward those who succeeded at it. These included a close friend in college, an even closer and much older friend in Missoula, and one of his students whom he had thought the world of. Even before Dale's own descent into functional insanity, he had understood that suicides were not usually responsible for their decisions. His older friend, a French woman writer named Brigitte, had spent years battling depression before she locked herself in her bedroom and took two vials of hoarded sleeping pills, but Dale had always hated the narcissism of self-destruction, the ineluctable selfishness of the act. Brigitte had left 4 school-aged children behind. His former student, David, had left a pregnant young wife to deal with the trauma of finding his body hanging in the garage. It was, to Dale, inexcusable to leave such messes behind. Dale hated messes as much as he despised self-pity. Dale had once taught a semester-long seminar on Ernest Hemingway, and he had fallen into flat-out argument with a few of his smarter students on the writer's culpability in ending his life the way he did. "The selfish bastard pulled the trigger on his boss's shotgun right at the foot of the stairs," he had half-yelled, "so that Miss Mary would have no choice but to walk through the puddles of blood and brains and shards of skull on her way to the phone. His dear Miss Mary had been the one to leave the keys to his gun case in plain view on the kitchen windowsill," said his sharpest student, not retreating a bit. "Perhaps he was just acknowledging her choice and making her pay for it a bit." Dale had actually glared at Claire across the seminar table. "Don't you think that he was making her pay too high a price for agreeing with him that access to a man's property was his right?" "After he'd received shock treatment for depression," said Claire. "After he'd tried to walk into a spinning propeller during the flight to the clinic. After Miss Mary had needed to call a friend over to the Idaho house to wrestle a shotgun away from Hemingway the week before. No, I don't think he made her pay too high a price. Besides, she received and exploited to the teeth all of his copyrights, including those miserable posthumous books that he never would have chosen to see in print. I think Hemingway knew exactly what he was doing when he sat on the steps to blow his brains out, knowing full well what Miss Mary would have to step through to get downstairs to the phone. They each got what they wanted." Dale had blinked at Claire's toughness on this. He had had no idea. Dale Stewart! Dale almost dropped the last sack of groceries he was putting in the rear of the Land Cruiser. The last thing he expected to hear in the parking lot of the Oak Hill City Market was someone calling his name. 2 women walked quickly toward him across the wet tarmac. The one who had called his name was vaguely familiar, but still a stranger to him. Indeterminate middle age, red hair that had been cropped short, one's fair skin that had been tanned to the consistency of leather, evidence of plastic surgery in the sharp face and neck and breasts. Breasts too large and round and firmly packed, even glimpsed through a sweater, hardly an Oak Hill or Elm Haven sort of person. The other woman was short, scowling, stocky, and sporting a phys-ed woman teacher's butch haircut. Dale, who was usually naive about such things, knew at once that the redhead and the short brunette were a couple. Dale, who had practiced safe political correctness for more than 20 professional academic years, indulged himself in the thought, "Dykes."
"You don't remember me, do you?"
said the redhead.
"I'm sorry," said Dale. "I'm not sure." "Michelle Staffney," said the woman. "Now I go by Micah Stouffer."
Dale could only stare. Michelle Staffney had been the little sex grenade of his fourth, fifth, and sixth grade classes at Old Central School. Every boy in Elmhaven during the period 1957 and 1960 had probably celebrated his first erotic fantasies with Michelle Staffney in a starring role, unless they opted for Annette Funicello, and now this worn and sharp-boned middle-aged woman with breast implants and a whiskey cigarette voice.
"Micah Stouffer?" Dale said stupidly. "I was out in L.A. for a lot of years," said Michelle, as if that explained everything. "What the hell are you doing back here in Illinois?"
"I'm—" began Dale, and then stopped. "How on earth did you recognize me, Michelle?" "Micah." She smiled. The smile, at least, reminded him of the delectable, soft-voiced little girl he had known.
"One of the producers I was living with had a copy of your book that some lame dick screenwriter was trying to push, the second Jeremiah Johnson or something. They wanted Bob Redford for the leading role, but Redford wouldn't even read the treatment. But the book was always lying around in the bathroom or somewhere. I read the bio under your photo one day and decided that you were the same Dale Stewart I knew in Elmhaven about 200 years ago."
"My book," repeated Dale. "Do you remember which one?"
"Does it matter?" said Michelle,
the little girl's smile flickering into something much older and tougher.
"I didn't read the thing, didn't read it personally, as they say out there, but the screenwriter told my producer friend that all of your books were essentially the same one, big, tough, mountain man shit. He said that if we optioned one, we'd really own all of them. Oh, this is Diane Villanova."
Dale shook hands with the brunette and had to flex his fingers afterward.
"So what are you doing back here, Dale Stewart?" said Michelle, Micah.
For a mad instant, Dale considered telling her the whole sad story of the last few years of his life, right down to his last view of Claire and all about Anne's contemptuous farewell. Instead, he said, "Writing a book, I think."
"I thought you were a teacher or something as well?"
"Professor of English," said Dale, wondering if that were still true. "University of Montana at Missoula on sabbatical." He could hear the staccato telegraph style of his speech and wondered where it was coming from.
"And you're staying in Oak Hill?"
There was incredulity in her voice. "Near Elmhaven, actually," he said, "renting Dwayne McBride's farmhouse for a few months." Michelle Staffney blinked at this.
"Dwayne McBride? The kid who was killed in that awful farm accident when we were 10 or something?"
11 or 12, said Dale. "Summer of 1960, yeah?" Michelle looked at her friend and then back at Dale.
"That's weird, but no weirder than our situation, I guess."
Dale waited.
"Diane and I are spending a few months at my folks' home in Elmhaven."
"On Broad Street," said Dale, "the big house with the big barn behind it."
"Yep, the same. Only when I lived there as a kid, it was a great house. Hell, even a great barn. Now it's all a ramshackle fucking mess. Di and I are trying to get it fixed up a bit so we can sell it, hoping that there's some rich, snot-nosed young couple out of Peoria who wants a big Victorian house and who won't check the wiring or the furnace or anything."
"Are your parents—" began Dale. He always felt strange asking someone his own age about their parents. His own folks had died young in the 1960s.
"Dad died in, Jesus, 1975, said Michelle. "But Mom just hung in there, senile as a loon, warehoused away in Alzheimer Manor here in Oak Hill for a few decades, until she died a couple of months ago."
"I'm sorry," said Dale.
"Don't be. It would have been a blessing for everyone if she'd shoved off years and years ago. Anyway, the house was empty and needed work, so it gave Di and me an excuse to get out of L.A. and away from the industry for a while.
Dale heard the capital I in industry. Just like everyone else in L.A., he thought.
You were involved with movies?
He said politely.
Producing? No,
said Michelle, the mica smile returning and then fading. I was mostly fucking producers, even married two of them. I was an actress.
Of course, said Dale, making a conscious effort not to drop his gaze to the obviously unfettered and obviously unnatural breasts under her sweater.
Have you been in anything I might have seen?
He hated questions like that. Why did I ask it?
When people asked him, have you written anything I might have read, his impulse was always to say, I don't know, do you read anything decent or just the occasional John Grisham crap?
Did you see Titanic?
Asked Michelle.
Wow, said Dale. You were in that?
Nope.
But I was in It's Alive 4 that went straight to video the same month Titanic came out, and I was one of the alien dancers in the spaceship scene in The Fifth Element with Bruce Willis, the one with the bare blue tits. That was the last time anyone hired me, more than 4 years ago.
Dale nodded sympathetically.
Bare blue tits, he thought, keeping his gaze level with hers through an act of will.
Diane touched Michelle's arm as if reminding her that it was cold and wet out here in the parking lot.
Yeah, said Michelle. Well, hell, we really should get together sometime and swap lies about the good old days. Di and I will probably be here through Christmas, maybe longer given the mess we have to deal with. You got a card with your phone number?
She took out a pen and scribbled her number on her grocery receipt and gave it to him. Dale dug out a business card, using her pen to scratch out his ranch, university, and home phone numbers, and circling the mobile phone number.
The only problem, he said, is that cell phones don't seem to work around Elm Haven.
Michelle raised an eyebrow.
That's what I'm using there as my only phone. It works fine in town.
Dale shrugged. Well, I guess there's a dead area out near the McBride farm. Michelle looked as if she was going to say something, stopped herself, tapped him on the arm and said,
I'm serious about gabbing. Come on over and we'll cook you a good dinner and drink a shitload of tequila.
The two women walked back to their Toyota pickup and drove off.
Michelle Staffney, said Dale, still standing in the rain. Jesus Christ.
7. Dale had driven only a few miles south out of Oak Hill toward Elm Haven when the two pickup trucks cut him off. At first he thought it was Michelle and her friend in the white pickup, approaching quickly in the rearview mirror, but then he saw that it was not a new Toyota truck, but a beat-up old Chevy with another old pickup, this one a scabrous green Ford roaring along just behind it. Dale slowed down, waiting for the idiots to pass, but the first pickup pulled up alongside and stayed there, slowing when he did, accelerating when he did. Dale glanced over, saw the black leather jackets and the shaved heads, and thought, oh, shit. The white Chevy pickup passed him and then slowed. The green Ford pickup pulled closer to his rear bumper. Suddenly, the white pickup in front of him hit the brakes. Dale braked hard, lurching forward against the Land Cruiser's shoulder harness, but still had to swerve right to avoid the Chevy. Luckily, there was a gravel turnout by the side of the road, some sort of small picnic area rest stop. The Land Cruiser slid to a stop in the gravel there, and the green and white trucks blocked his way out. Three young men spilled out of the white Chevy pickup. Two more jumped out of the cab of the green Ford. All five of them had extremely short hair or shaved heads. All five wore black leather coats and combat boots. The tallest of the five had a swastika tattooed on the back of his right hand. The tallest was also the oldest, perhaps in his middle 20s, and the youngest looked to be about 16. At least three of the five were taller and heavier than Dale. Dale had perhaps 10 seconds to decide what to do. It wouldn't have been a problem for Dale's father. He had always carried a lug wrench tucked under the driver's seat of the family station wagon. Dale had always noticed that fact, but had never asked his dad why he carried the heavy lug wrench there. Now he knew. But Dale Stewart, even while living and traveling in the wilds of Montana, had never thought that he needed a weapon handy. He wished like hell that he had one now. Heart-pounding, Dale briefly considered locking the truck's doors and waiting in the Land Cruiser. He even considered throwing the truck into four-wheel drive, going up and over the curb, driving through the grassy picnic area and the adjoining cornfield if necessary, and making a run for it down the county road. His pride kept him from doing either. Dale stepped out and down just as the five skinheads made a semicircle around him. Well, he thought, there's still an outside chance that they are Jim Bridger Mountain Man fans. You the Jew boy Zionist motherfucker, snarled the tallest of the skinheads. There goes the fan theory, thought Dale. He was amazed to realize that his pulse rate had fallen back to near normal and that he was no longer frightened. Perhaps the situation was just too absurd for him to take seriously. It seemed like a bad post-millennial remake of Gentleman's Agreement by way of Deliverance. Dale took his cell phone out of his jacket pocket and held it up with his thumb over the speed dial button. None of the programmed speed dial numbers would do him a damn bit of good, even if the phone condescended to work out here in the boonies. But maybe the skinheads didn't know. Standing there, phone poised, Dale felt a bit like Captain Kirk preparing to have Scotty beam him up. Yeah, I wish, he thought. One of you named Derek? Said Dale, his voice strong and steady, all the while shooting an, I'm an adult, and you're going to be in deep shit in a minute. Look at each of the punks. The skinheads blinked. The next to youngest, an overweight mouth breather who looked to be the least sharp knife in this particular drawer, actually blushed through his acne and took a step back. Dale fixed his heavy glare on Derek for a minute and then moved it to the leader's face. You didn't answer our question, asshole, said the leader, a gaunt-faced, hollow-eyed fascist, if there ever was one. You that nigger-loving Jew boy that wrote those magazine things? Articles, said Dave. Magazine and newspaper articles. That's your vocabulary word for the day, no charge. Four of the five stared blankly at him. Obviously, they had not imagined the dialogue going quite this way in their fetid little power fantasies, and the discrepancy threw them off stride. The leader reached into his jacket pocket with a menacing glower. Will it be a knife or pistol? Wondered Dale as he raised his own weapon, the useless cell phone. He heard himself say, I know Derek, of course, looking straight at Derek, but I'll need to know all of your names when I punch the state police number here. But I guess they'll already know who Derek hangs around with. Four of the skinheads looked at their leader. The older man's hand came out of his pocket. Ah, thought the strangely detached part of Dale's mind. Knife it is. He had always hated edged weapons. The other four clicked out their own knives. Not switchblades, but ridiculously long survival knives that came from scabbards under their jackets. Dale punched Claire's speed dial number at the same time, surreptitiously touching cancel as he heard the dial tone and the first rings, and raised the phone. Get the fuck out of here and stay out, said the oldest skinhead. He nodded to his pals. The younger boys slashed the closest two of Dale's tires. Dale made no move to stop them. The lead skinhead gave Dale the finger. An oddly childish gesture under the circumstances, Dale thought, and then all five were scrambling back into their pickups and roaring away, throwing gravel against the Land Cruiser and Dale. Dale waited a minute to make sure they were really gone and then checked the damage. He had a can of flat sealant in his emergency kit in the back, but these tires were well and truly slashed, and he had only one spare. Dale dialed 911. Amazingly, someone answered. Crevecoeur County Emergency Services, please state the nature of your emergency. Feeling sheepish, Dale explained his situation and asked for the number of a towing service in Oak Hill. The 911 lady did not chastise him for using the emergency number for frivolous purposes, but gave him the number of a repair garage with towing service, offered to connect him, told him to call back if the belligerent youths, her phrase, returned, and then told him to sit tight, that someone would be there in 15 minutes or less. I don't need, began Dale, but the 911 lady had signed off. Dale had not called the sheriff, but the sheriff arrived before the tow truck. Dale took one look at the fat man getting out of the Greene County sheriff's car and felt his heart pounding with fear. C.J. Congdon looked nothing like he had in 1960. The thin, lanky bully had gone to fat, but the mean eyes and yellow teeth and stupid expression were somehow the same. It can't be him, thought Dale. But the fat man wheezed closer, and Dale saw the name tag over the badge. CJ. Dale tried to remember the last time he had seen CJ Congdon. An image came back of the 16-year-old, mean-eyed bully hanging Dale over the edge of the Spoon River Bridge, while Dale's 11-year-old friend Jim Harlan aimed a snub-nosed .38 revolver at Congdon's hot rod and threatened to pull the trigger if the bully dropped Dale into the river. What the hell was that all about? Wondered Dale. If it was a real memory, it was one that he had forgotten for more than 40 years. Sheriff Congdon stepped closer, looked at the Land Cruiser's deflated tires, and said, "What the hell happened here?" It was the same bully's voice, thickened by decades of cigarettes and power, but the same voice. Dale had to clear his throat before speaking. He told Congdon about the skinheads, all the while praying that Congdon wouldn't recognize him. Do bullies remember their prey?
Yeah, I know 'em,
said the sheriff, squinting at Dale through sunglasses. He was talking about the skinheads.
But do I know you?
Said Congdon. Dale shook his head, afraid to speak, afraid that CJ would remember his voice. The sheriff walked around the rear of the Land Cruiser and squinted at the license plates.
Montana. You're just passing through, mister?
Miller, said Dale, and immediately realized that if and when Congdon asked to see his license, he'd be in trouble, certainly more trouble than the local skinhead punks. Tom Miller, said Dale. Yeah, I'm just driving through on my way to Cincinnati. Congdon squinted at him and rested his thumbs in his gun belt. Leather creaked. The sheriff's gray shirt was dirty and straining at the belly. If he asks me for my license and registration, I'll say that I forgot them, thought Dale in a panic, and realized at once that this would not work. He'd just end up in the county jail while they traced the registration. He shook his head. What the hell am I panicked about? I haven't done anything wrong. I'm the victim here. That was the reasonable point of view, but Dale remembered those mean pig eyes of C.J. Congdon's behind a shotgun aimed at Dale's head when he was a boy. There was no statute of limitations on bullies and their victims. The fat sheriff opened his mouth to speak, but right then the radio in his cruiser squawked and hissed. Congdon leaned into the open door, listened a minute, said something into his radio, and hung it up. Congdon straightened up, rested his hands on his gun belt again, and turned back to Dale.
Do you want to ride back to Oak Hill with me? We got to get some paperwork done if you're going to swear out a complaint.
I'd rather have a colonoscopy with a roto-rooter, thought Dale. He shrugged as if it didn't matter to him.
I'll ride back in the tow truck. I need to get some junk out of the Land Cruiser. Congdon squinted at him again as if trying to remember where they'd met. Finally, he shrugged.
Suit yourself. Just make sure that you stop by the sheriff's office.
Dale nodded and watched the former bully wheeze his way back to his sheriff's car, get in, and drive off. The tow truck arrived less than a minute after Congdon's sheriff's car disappeared. The two mechanics, Billy and Tuck, were efficient in getting the cruiser slung into its towing cradle.
"We could change the one tire here for you," said Billy, the older of the two brothers. "Wouldn't do no good, though. I don't think anybody in Oak Hill's got any of these tires in stock. Probably have to bring one in from Peoria or Galesburg tomorrow afternoon, maybe."
Dale nodded. "Is there a place to rent a car in Oak Hill?" The brothers shook their heads. Then Turk said,
"Wait a minute. Mr. Jurgen over at the Happy Lanes rents out his dead wife's car sometimes."
"That'll do," said Dale.
Dale did not get out of Oak Hill until after 7 p.m. The tires would be delivered the next day, and he could pick up the cruiser the next afternoon. He ate dinner at the counter of a Five and Dime on the city square. Not a Woolworth's, they had all disappeared from America years before, and Mr. Jurgen brought his late wife's blue Buick by from the bowling alley. The Buick was older than most people Dale knew. It reeked of cigarette smoke, and it cost Dale more to rent than it would have to rent a luxury car from Hertz, and he had to leave $300 for a damage deposit
but he was glad to pay and get out of Oak Hill before C.J. Congdon thought to come looking for him. It started to snow again during his drive back to Duane's farmhouse. Dale was sleepy as he turned down the long lane and drove past the dead trees, snow dancing in his headlights, but he woke up quickly and slammed on the brakes 100 yards from the farmhouse. Dale had not left any lights on when he had driven off to buy groceries earlier in the day. The downstairs was dark, but there was a light burning on the second floor. 8. Dale sat in the reeking Buick, looking at the light glowing in the second floor upper left window, listening to pellets of sleet bouncing off the windshield, and thought, "Fuck this." He backed the rattling old car down the long lane, pulled out onto County 6, and headed back south. Dale had seen enough scary movies in his life. He knew that his role now was to go into the dark farmhouse by himself, call, "Is somebody there?" go fearfully up the stairs, and then get cut down by the waiting axe murderer. Either that, or realtor Sandy Whitaker had let herself in with her key, cut through the layers of plastic at the top of the stairs, and even at that moment was waiting for him naked on one of the beds up there. Fuck that, too. Dale drove up the second hill and paused at the stop sign at Jubilee College Road. He wasn't sure where to head next. "Montana," came his answer. He shook his head. Besides a natural reluctance to abandon his $50,000 Land Cruiser in a swap for this cigarette-stinking old Buick, he had nowhere to go in Montana. The ranch was rented out. Missoula was hostile territory for him these days. He had no job this year at the university there. Oak Hill? That made sense, since his truck was there and would be ready the next afternoon, but Dale could not remember if Oak Hill even had a motel. And if it did, it was a primitive one. He crossed Jubilee College Road, took the narrow cut-off road through frozen fields to 150A, kept going straight and turned east onto an empty I-74. 25 minutes later, he was in Peoria. Exiting onto War Memorial Drive, he found a Comfort Suites, paid with his American Express, asked the counter guy for a toothbrush, and went up to his room. It smelled of carpet cleaner and other chemicals. The king-size bed was almost obscene in its immensity. A card on top of the TV offered him recent release movies, including softcore dirty movies. Dale sighed, went back out to the rented Buick, and grabbed the sack of groceries that held fruit drinks and some snacks. He rooted around in another bag, found the new tube of toothpaste, and tossed it into the bag. That left only another $230 worth of groceries in sacks covering the back seat, the rear floor, and the front seat of the car. He carried the bag back up to his room, kicked off his boots and sweater, and munched Fig Newtons and sipped orange juice while watching CNN. After a while, he turned off the TV, went in the bathroom, and brushed his teeth. Eventually, he went to sleep. Dale awoke with the kind of absolute, heart-pounding, bottom-dropping-out-of-everything-sense of desperation that comes most solidly between 3 and 4 a.m. He looked at the motel alarm clock, 3:26 a.m. He sat up in bed, turned on the light, and ran his hands over his face. His hands were shaking. He didn't think that it had been a nightmare that had brought him swimming up out of a troubled sleep. It was simply a sense that the world was ending. No, he realized, that wasn't quite right. It was simply the conviction that the world had already ended. The clickover of the century and millennium had been problematic for Dale. Of course, his life had turned to shit about that time, and he tried to kill himself, but even more troubling than that had been his deep and silent conviction that everything of value to him had been left behind in the old century. Tonight, that conviction was totally pervasive and endlessly empty. Christ, thought Dale. I left my Prozac, Flurazepam, and Doxepin at Duane's farmhouse. He had to smile at the thought. An old short circuit brings a light on the second floor of a farmhouse, and Professor Dale Stewart blows his brains out for lack of meds. Difficult, he thought. I left the Savage over and under at the farmhouse, too. Dale glanced at the phone. He could call Dr. Hall. It was earlier in Montana, only about 2:30 a.m., Psychiatrist must be used to that crap. What would I tell him? Well, the black dog was back. That had been Dale's term of choice for deep depression, borrowed from Winston Churchill, who had been plagued by his own black dog for decades. Churchill had saved his life by taking up oil painting. Why is the black dog back? Dale went into the bathroom, ran some tap water into one of the little plastic glasses, sanitarily wrapped for his protection, and came back and sat on the small couch and thought about it. I don't like running away from here, from Duane's place. Why not? Duane's farm and Elmhaven and Oak Hill and C.J. Congdon and even Michelle Staffney were depressing enough in their own right. Wouldn't it be a good idea to leave now? No. Missoula and the ranch were out of bounds for him now. He knew that. If he returned, it was probable that he would finish what he started on November 4th a year earlier. But why Duane's drafty old place? Why Elmhaven? Because he had old connections there. Because the place had changed, for the worse, but so had he. And perhaps it was necessary for him to find that connection to his childhood, to something good about himself, to Duane, to the reason he became a writer and a teacher. And there's the book. This is the only place I can write it. For the first time, he consciously acknowledged that he was going to spend his sabbatical year writing a novel about Duane, about Elmhaven, about 1960, about the summer he had so much trouble remembering, and ultimately about himself. Vanity, vanity, vanity. He knew better. It would take great humility to write this novel. Humility, not the professional, historical, commercial, and auctorial cleverness that went into his Jim Bridger Mountain Man books. This novel would be just for him, and he would need both Duane's notebooks and a connection with Duane's life to write it. The heater hummed on. A big truck roared up through its endless gears out on War Memorial Drive. Dale turned the light out and went back to sleep, even without his Prozac and Flurazepam and Doxepin.
Stuart! Dale! Stuart!
Dale paused just outside the garage where the mechanics were finishing mounting the Land Cruiser's wheels with his two new tires. He looked over his shoulder, but he had recognized the voice. Sheriff C.J. Congdon was strolling across the oily concrete driveway toward him. Congdon had one hand on the revolver in his holster. He was wheezing slightly as he came. Dale waited.
"Miller, huh?" said Congdon. "Tom Miller. Yeah, cute. Well, I knew I'd seen your ugly ass face before."
"Do you want something, Sheriff?" Unlike the day before, Dale's pulse did not race. He felt completely calm.
"Why'd you lie to me, Stuart?" snapped Congdon. "I had to fucking arrest you."
"For not telling you my real name?" said Dale and smiled.
"For misrepresenting yourself to a peace officer," wheezed Congdon.
His fat fingers continued tapping at the grip of his revolver. Leather creaked. Dale shrugged and waited. Congdon squinted at him.
"I remember you, Stuart. You and that fucking bunch of weasel friends of yours."
"Watch your language, Sheriff," said Dale. "You're a public servant now, not the town bully. Get nasty with me and I'll swear out a complaint."
"Fuck your complaint," growled Congdon, but he looked around the garage to see who was listening.
The brrr of the air wrench putting on the Land Cruiser's lug nuts sufficiently covered the conversation.
"And fuck you, Stuart."
"You have a nice day too, Sheriff," said Dale, and turned back to watch them lower his truck on the lift. Congdon walked toward the open garage door and then paused.
"I know where you're staying."
Dale was sure that he did. It was a small county. Congdon walked away and Dale called after him. "Hey, Sheriff, any luck finding those punks who just cost me more than $300? C.J. Congdon did not look back. The beautiful morning had shamed Dale. The snow had turned into sleet during the night, the sleet into rain, but the morning dawned sunny and warmer and sweet-smelling. Dale went out to breakfast at a pancake house across the parking lot from the Comfort Suites. The food was good, the coffee was good, and the waitress was friendly. Dale read the morning Peoria Journal Star and felt better than he had in weeks. War Memorial Drive became Highway 150 outside of Peoria, and Dale drove the Buick the back way to Elmhaven, leaving the window open to air the cigarette smell out of the car. He was surprised to note that half of the trees still had their leaves, and that those leaves still held deep fall colors. It was a beautiful day. Just at the edge of Peoria's western limits, About 10 miles beyond the city he'd known as a boy in Elmhaven, there was a plaza with a hardware and a sports store. Dale visited both and came out with a 36-inch crowbar and a Louisville Slugger baseball bat. He tossed both in the trunk of the Buick and drove on to Duane's farmhouse. The fields on either side of the approach lane were wet and sweet-smelling. Dale stopped the Buick in front of the house, but there was no way he could tell if the upstairs light was on in all that blazing daylight. He pulled to the side, parked the Buick, retrieved the baseball bat from the trunk, and walked up to the side door. It was locked, just as he'd left it. Dale let himself in and stood in the kitchen a moment. "Hello?" He heard the slightest echo of his own voice and had to smile. He'd be damned if he'd yell, "Is anyone there?" just before the supernatural killer in the hockey mask jumped out to cut him down. He searched the first floor. Everything seemed to be as he'd left it. He went down to the basement. No hockey mask killers there. He remembered that he'd stored his Savage over and under down here in two pieces, but after checking that the pieces were where he'd put them, he decided not to add it to his Louisville Slugger arsenal. Besides, he'd thrown away the only shotgun shell. Dale went up the stairs. The layers of yellowing plastic were intact. Dale checked the nails and staples around the wood frame, but they had not been pulled out or replaced. The frame itself had been nailed into the door frame at the head of the stairs decades ago. Dale pushed against the plastic, but it yielded only slightly, crackling a bit. If someone had visited the upstairs, they'd not come this way. Not if they're human. Dale had deliberately phrased that thought to amuse himself, but in the darkness of the stairway, it didn't seem that funny. He leaned closer to peer through the heavy plastic. The vague outlines of a hallway and a table. Sunlight through thick curtains. Nothing moved. Dale pulled out his multi-use knife and set the longest blade against the plastic. He hesitated a second, and then folded the blade back and set the knife back in his pocket. He laid the baseball bat against the yellowed plastic and tapped it lightly. Let sleeping dogs lie. As if on cue, there came the scrabble of claws against the linoleum downstairs. Dale whirled, bat raised, just in time to see a very small black dog run from the parlor hall into the kitchen. "Jesus Christ!" said Dale, his heart pounding. He clattered down the stairs and ran into the kitchen just in time to see the outer screen bang shut. He'd left the inner door open, and the little dog had been able to push the screen door out. Dale ran outside and stood on the stoop, bat ready. He half expected the small black dog to be out of sight. A delusion. But there it went, running hell-bent for leather toward the outbuildings behind the farm, its little black ass wiggling as it ran. Dale almost laughed. He'd been ready for the undead killer in the hockey mask, and instead he'd found a lap dog. Whatever the little thing was, it was definitely a dog and definitely a shrimp, terrier-sized but short-haired, all black except for a glimpse of pale or pink on its muzzle, short ears. "Hey, dog!" yelled Dale and whistled. The little black dog did not slow down. It disappeared through a hole in the first outbuilding, the one Dale remembered Duane calling the chicken coop. If the dog was in the house, why didn't I find it when I searched? Dale shook his head but walked out to the chicken coop. The shed was a mess. The door had been wired shut. Dale had to unwrap a yard of rusted wire, but one side of the structure had rotted away between the wood and the foundation until the hole was large enough for that dog to slip through. But it was a runt of a dog. Dale propped the door open and looked in the coop. "Jesus Christ," he said again, softly this time. He took the gold Dunhill lighter out of his pocket and flicked it on, holding the lighter high. There was just enough light to see by, but not enough to show detail. He walked back to the farmhouse and returned with a flashlight. The interior of the coop had a fossilized layer of chicken manure mixed with embedded white feathers. The roosts were empty, and the straw was ancient. The boards, walls, and floor were covered with dried blood, aged to a deep brown patina. There was no sign of the dog. "What the hell happened in here?" Dale said aloud, but he knew the answer. Fox. Fox in the henhouse. Or a dog. He had to smile again. Not this dog. It was too small. Hell, a chicken could have beaten up this little black dog. Dale looked in all of the roosts and niches, but no black dog. On the west wall, however, there were more slats missing. The pooch had probably run right through the chicken coop. Dale went out into the bright sunlight and wonderful autumn air and checked in the mud at the west end of the coop. Sure enough, tiny dog tracks crossed the lot toward another of the handful of small sheds and outbuildings. Well, I guess it isn't a ghost dog. It left tracks. He tried whistling and calling again, but no dog appeared. Knowing that he should be hauling his groceries in, Dale checked out the other sheds. The dog's prints had disappeared here where the grass grew, but the second shed had an open door. Dale's flashlight flicked across hanging harnesses, hanging blades, hanging saws, hanging butchering equipment. All of it was rusted. The next shed boasted a padlock, but the hinges had given way, and Dale merely lifted the door to one side. Inside was a circa 1940s electrical generator, a mass of black cables, and half a dozen gas canisters. Only one of the jerry cans held gasoline. Dale checked over the generator, but even a cursory inspection with the flashlight showed insulated wires that had been chewed through by mice, rusted and corroded points, missing leads, and an empty fuel tank. Behind the generator shed was a huge oval fuel tank set low in girders, obviously a fueling station for the farm equipment. Unlike the other sheds and equipment, this gas tank looked as if it was still in use. The rubber hoses and nozzles had been maintained or replaced, which made sense if Mr. Johnson next door stored his tractor and combine in the barn and still tilled this land. Dale rapped on the 200-gallon tank. It sounded full. He had to remember that if his Land Cruiser ever ran out of gas. There were three more tiny outbuildings, but they had all but collapsed. The black dog might be hiding in any one of them, but Dale had no intention of crawling in after him. That left the barn. Dale had planned to visit the barn at some point. It might as well be now. Holding the flashlight in one hand and the Louisville slugger in the other, he approached the huge structure. Dale had vague memories of being in Duane's barn as a kid. Of all of Illinois' glories, the giant barns might have been the most interesting to a kid. Some of the farms boasted barns big enough to play baseball in, the lofts 30 feet high and filled with sweet-smelling hay. Perfect places to play as a boy. This barn had a main door on the east side, but it was chained and padlocked. The huge barn doors on the south side did not budge, locked from the inside or frozen on their metal tracks. Dale hesitated. He didn't know if his rental agreement allowed him to wander around the barn and other outbuildings. He imagined that these were used for storage by Mr. Johnson. Dale walked back to the Buick, ignored the waiting groceries, and traded the Louisville slugger for the crowbar. He walked the 60 yards or so to the huge, looming barn, stuck the flashlight in his jeans pocket, forced the curve of the crowbar into the gap in the large doors, and struggled and cursed until something snapped. In the door, luckily, not in his back, and the doors squealed back on their rusted tracks. Dale stepped into the darkness and then took a fast step back out into the light. The huge harvesting combine all but filled the central space. Long, rust-mottled gatherer points thrust toward Dale from the 30-foot-wide attached corn head. The glass-enclosed cab, seeming infinitely high above, was dark. Dale breathed through his open mouth, felt his heart pound, and was amazed that he remembered terms and details about the combine. Cornhead, snapper rolls, lugged chains, shields. It can't be the same machine. His friend Duane had been chewed up and swallowed by a combine here, under circumstances no one had understood then or now. At night, when Duane was alone at the farm, Duane's old man, Duane's invariable term for his father, had a solid alibi. Drunk in Peoria with half a dozen cronies, and no one had suspected the old man. It can't be the same machine. This combine was old enough to have been there then, but it was green. The machine, old even in 1960, that had killed Duane had been red. How did I remember that? Thought Dale in something like wonder, but he did remember it. And the metal shields over the gatherer points and snapping rolls had been off when they found the machine in the field and Duane's remains in the works. Mr. McBride had removed them weeks or months earlier, meaning to repair the rolls. Now this huge green combine had its shields in place. Dale shook his head and walked around the combine, running the flashlight beam over the empty glass cab and the maze of metal ladders and catwalks on the giant machine. As large as it was, the combine took up only a third of the floor space in the huge barn. Doors and gates led to side rooms off the central space, and wooden ladders ran up to not one but half a dozen lofts. Dale flicked the flashlight beam toward the eaves 50 feet above, but he saw only darkness. But he heard the frenzied flutter of wings. Bats, he thought, but another part of his mind said, no, sparrows. He remembered now, that was the first time he had been in Duane's barn, a summer night when he and his brother, Lawrence, and their friend Mike O'Rourke had walked the gravel road from Uncle Henry and Aunt Lena's farm and shot sparrows in Duane's barn. First they froze the sparrows in the beams of their flashlights, and then they shot them with their BB guns. Not all of the sparrows had died. The BB guns were not that powerful. Duane had opened the barn doors for them, but he had not taken part. Dale remembered Duane's ancient collie, Wittgenstein, hanging back with Duane in the dark doorway, the dog excited by the boy's bloodlust and the wild fluttering of the sparrows, but not leaving his friend's side. To hell with this, said Dale. He went out of the barn, pulled the screeching doors as shut as he could get them, and went back to unload his groceries. On the way, he walked around the farmhouse, checking to see if there was another way anyone could have gotten to the second floor. The tall old farmhouse had no easy way to the six windows, more than 15 feet up there. The windows were all shut, most covered on the inside by drapes or curtains or both. Someone with a tall ladder might have done it, but the dirt around the farmhouse was all mud after the night's rain, and there were no footprints or marks from a ladder. I guess whoever turned on the light lives up there, thought Dale. It was hard to scare himself in the bright daylight under the blue sky. He set the crowbar on the baseball bat just inside the kitchen door and went out to ferry in his small fortune's worth of groceries, trying not to track in too much mud as he did so.